Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick. We're here to continue. In fact, this is the final episode of our Evolution series, the Evolution of the NFL. Tonight, we're talking about how the game is played. We've talked about the rules. We've talked about the economics. We've talked about the league structure. This is how the game is played. Certainly a topic that I think a lot of people have interest in. Joining me today is Colt Scardina. How are you doing, Colt?
I'm doing great, Ken. Thank you again for having me back. It's sort of bittersweet. You know, it'll be nice to put a bow on this Evolution series that we're doing, but it'll be sad to see it go because I'm just having a blast talking to you about all this stuff.
This is a lot of fun. These conversations are always fun, but that just means we have to come up with the next project. So I'm looking forward to that one, too.
Yeah.
So, perhaps the place to talk about how the game is played is to talk about a little bit about the history of how the game has changed over the years. And the NFL has a long history. I'm not going to go back to the very, very beginning of it. I'm going to start in about 1950. I think people know that the modern passing game and whatnot actually started before then. Don Hutson, of course, was the NFL's first big receiver for the 30s Packers. The passing game didn't really come back until the 1950s and kind of the same level until the post-war era. But in the 1950s, the game was characterized by a very high interception rate. And this is something that really shows up when you're looking at normalized interceptions to era. And you've maybe heard me talk about Ed Reed and Marcus Peters, who are 1 and 2 at one point. Reed, I believe, is still number one in terms of interceptions relative to era per game play. So at over 7 per 16 game played, it's really well ahead of the rest of the field. And that's normalized to some recent years interceptions. And a friend of mine, definitely a great follow on Twitter, Yoshi2052. You want to make sure you hit him up because he'll give you the most recent data, I'm sure, if you just ask him for it. But this is a interesting change we have today. Interception rates now are they're just over 1%. I'd have to actually look to see what the league interception rate was in a recent season. I'll do that while Colt makes his point. But Colt, can you imagine if Ed Reed was put in a league with a 7.4% interception rate?
I mean, what is the what is the counter to Ed Reed in the 1950s? Do you just never throw the ball past 5 yards?
That might be it. In his rookie season, Night Train Lane had 14 interceptions in 12 games. See the league was still, they were throwing the ball a fair amount. There were a good number of interceptions per game. Teams were not as conscious about about taking care of the football. They would use the forward pass as a punt in some situations. So if it's third and long, you throw it deep and that's your punt. Mm-hmm. And, there were teams willing to, use that, but the interception rate, at that point was, over 7%. And today, I'm going to get it for you here because I really need to know this here in terms of passing interception percentage is 2.4% in the NFL today. So it's a third of what it was at that time.
Yeah, so I think if you're playing in the 50s, you're also thinking your guys are going to get it back just as easily as you're giving it up. So almost a ping pong effect to the game, and like you said, like a long punt, it's effectively the same thing. So why not take a gamble on third and 10?
Yeah, it was definitely a different time for football. They had some high-flying passing attacks, so there were some guys putting up big passing numbers, but they were doing a lot of interceptions, and passer ratings by today's standards were a lot lower than they were. Johnny Unitas' career passer rating, I believe, was around 74.
Oh, really?
So it might have been 76, but it was very low by today's standards anyway.
And then I've always heard, and correct me if I'm wrong, correct me if this is just sports journalists playing with narratives that are easy for readers to stomach. But the right before the merger, AFL is the high-flying razzle-dazzle league, and the NFL is the three yards in a cloud of dust and all defense. Is that accurate, or is that a little bit urban legendy?
I think there was more passing in the AFL. They had 10 teams. Joe Namath was in that league. They probably Put more of their money into signing some big quarterbacks. You had some other guys. John Hadle was a very effective quarterback with the Chargers, who was a passing quarterback. I try to think of some of the other great passing quarterbacks from the league. There were some teams who did it on the ground too. I'm thinking of Jack Kemp was a quarterback for the Bills when they were successful, and I have to kind of work my way through this. Len Dawson be another guy who was an effective quarterback at that time with the Chiefs.
Yeah. So. And if you're spending all your money, if you're the Jets and you're spending all your money on your quarterback, of course you want him to throw the ball rather than hand off. And then there's, of course, less money to spend on defense. So if the NFL has all the great defensive players and the AFL is sort of lacking in that area, it just makes sense. It just makes sense, strategically to air it out a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly would have made sense in that era, and we had some extraordinary numbers in the 60s. In the NFL, of course, he had the era of Jim Brown and the 9 rushing titles. I think he led the league in rushing his first 9 years, and Cleveland was one of the dominant teams, and Brown was certainly the most dominant player, probably still is the greatest player ever to play football, other than maybe one of the contemporary quarterbacks like Brady. He dominated the game certainly in a big way. The merger came in 1970. That changed a lot of things because it unified the draft in part. Teams didn't have the same amount of money because revenue sharing had not been adopted yet, and they didn't have free agency yet, but they had, they had a common draft as a good place to start in terms of having a game which is more balanced among more teams.
Right. Even it out not only between the leagues, but offensively and defensively. That just sort of makes sense once you're starting to draft from the same pool of players, and money is not, you can't lure, Joe Willie to your league by giving him, what was it, $400,000 in a Cadillac or whatever the story is.
Yeah. I don't know the exact story behind that. That's an interesting one. I know he shaved his mustache for $10,000 for a commercial.
Hey,
that's one of the things.
That's my rate too. So if you want the mustache gone, $10,000.
Yeah. So he also wore pantyhose for something, and it might have been only $30,000 at the time. But whatever the case, that might be below your rate. You have to adjust for inflation for that, I'm sure.
Yeah.
1970 is a big era of change for the NFL in terms of how they moved around the goalposts. They changed the passing game to make it easier to pass. The NFL has, took very extreme changes, made very extreme changes to adjust the game when they thought passing was really falling behind. And the Steelers had really dominated the mid-70s game with a bump and run coverage of Mel Blunt most famously, but lots of other cornerbacks in the league were getting away, just chucking receivers all the way down the field. And the NFL decided that wasn't good for the game. They wanted a more open passing game. They added a couple teams to the league that thins out the competition a little bit right there to start with. But they also had the 5 yard one hit rule. So now it's illegal contact beyond 5 yards, pass interference, spot foul. I don't know if that was not a spot foul before. I think it was a spot foul from earlier in the 70s at the very least.
Yeah, this is some of the stuff that we touched on last week, the Mel Blunt rule, I remember you saying. One thing I did want to bring up, just a quick tangent, it kind of got stuck in my head. I said that, in a way to balance the league or balance the offensive and defensive, misalignment that we have, that it might be smart to have to let defensive players just kind of run up to a bunch formation and knock them, the same way that we can do they can do a pick route. And that kind of bounced around in my head, and I just it came to the realization that was just dumb. And it's not that I'm anti skewing the game offensively. The league was smart to do it, as you just alluded to, with the Steelers dominating with the run game and opening up the passing game. It's just that some of the ways that they've modified the game, and this is something we'll get into at the end of the history part, really did, in my opinion, not just skew it, but just take it to a level where it's just not even fair to the defensive players. Right. But again, we can tackle that, because I know after the 70s, what it would be the sort of the Bill Walsh 80s, the West Coast offense really opening things up at that point.
Yeah, absolutely. In the '80s, you know, really the modern passing game with players like Marino in 83 and Montana, certainly in terms of what he brought to dominance with San Francisco, how he turned that franchise around, were you know, big events of that decade. In the 1990s, the Cowboys and 49ers dominated. And again, a lot of passing. Cowboys did it with some defense too. Mm-hmm. Obviously had Deion Sanders and you know, a set of other good defensive players that they were able to put on the field. And neither of those teams was bereft of defensive teams. But the only team that really was, well, there are only two that were really won a championship entirely on defense. That's the 2000 Ravens, who year after the Greatest Show on Turf debuted in St. Louis, you know, came back and won it with Big and Strong. And, you know, that's the way Phil Simms put it at the end of his Super Bowl wrap up, was how, you know, the league's being taken over again by the Big and the Strong.
Yeah, I mean, you throw in Jamal Lewis, of course, and controlling the clock. And then I believe the next year was the Tampa 2 championship.
2 years later.
Or 2 years later, right?
Yes, so but that's the other team.
Sorry, I didn't mean to step on your line there. But yeah, it was it looked like we had sort of hit the precipice and we were trending back down towards defense, because like you said, the Greatest Show on Turf and those early 80s Niners teams sort of felt like a bookend. Now, I do remember, I sort of have a vague recollection of the mid 90s being a very linebacker and big running back heavy, sort of like a demolition derby football. Whatever that thing is they have on their necks, the linebackers, everybody.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
Yeah, and they were just
high propped up shoulder pads that Ray Lewis wore when he was younger.
Exactly, yeah. Now they're all wearing like the very, very thin ones so they can be as fast as possible in coverage. But yeah, they looked almost like Transformers out there, just smashing into each other.
That's a good way to put it. And, you know, the era since then, since really 01 and 03 to the present, has really been dominated by the pocket quarterback. And we've had, you know, Brady and Manning and Roethlisberger in particular, you know, dominating then in terms of the Super Bowl wins. And, you know, I think when I look at the entire movement of professional football, they acted swiftly and I think decisively in the 70s to change the game. I think, you know, it created an extremely popular game. They never had any issues with popularity, frankly, even after, you know, coming back from the strikes in 82 and 87, the league never really had any issues. And, you know, baseball can't say the same thing and hockey can't say the same thing. Mm-hmm. If you look at what other sports have done, baseball has had certain maxims that it hasn't changed yet. Okay, since 1893 or 95, one of those two, I think 1893, they had the 60-foot, six-inch mound, and they've never changed that. They've had 90-foot bases for all of that era. In fact, going for that probably goes back to 1876, but I'm not sure. Anyway, the certain things have stayed the same, but nonetheless, baseball, you know, came out of the First World War. Popular, but not nearly as popular as it could be. Then they had a huge gambling scandal. And even though there weren't a lot of other sports in the United States for it to compete with, people, you know, were having their gambling taken away and they're having, you know, not knowing if their baseball is legitimate or not. And they wanted something new. And Landis, first of all, kicked a bunch of guys out of the game. But second of all, he really allowed, and the owners allowed, the home run to take over the game in the 20s. And it grew with just a couple of teams trying to really do it at first and other teams, you know, holding on saying, wait, this isn't our way of doing it. And then, you know, before long, every team had to do it or they weren't any good.
The floodgates were breached. Yeah. And I mean, so we talk about the live ball era and the dead ball era. I don't know if it's like now where every single day we have a story about the baseball and whether it's juiced or not. I'm assuming ratcheted those stitches a little bit tighter for the Babe Ruth and Gehrig and all those guys. But then also another funny parallel is you hear all these things about now we're playing in Matchbox stadiums, you know, all the stadiums are tiny, but I believe Ruth and Gehrig were hitting on it was 298 down the line to in old Yankee Stadium?
It was a ballpark that favored the pitcher overall, but it was very short to right field, and they were both left-handed hitters, so they both had, you know, good advantages in terms of that. So the Yankees knew how to build a ball club with a left-handed friendly park. By the way, I really like that the Orioles have effectively done that now. They've got a very unfriendly park for right-handed hitters. And, being friendly to left-handers means you can build your team that way. You can build it around left-handed pitching. You can build it around left-handed hitting, certainly. And it gives you a host of advantages.
And I heard somebody make that point earlier because they were going through all of Elias's recent draft picks, and a lot of them are either switch hitters or lefty power hitters, or even lefty contact hitters that can pull it down the line. I'm on the other side of the. I wasn't a fan of the wall move for other reasons. I'm glad I like what it's doing competitively, but man, when it gets under Aaron Judge's skin that much, it just really really brightens my day. It's great to see a Yankee throw a temper tantrum. So yes. You're a grown man. You're almost 7 feet tall and you're having a hissy fit. This is amazing.
this is a positive thing. And frankly, it's very difficult. I've always said this. And while I love Camden Yards, Memorial Stadium was more friendly, even though it was uniform in terms of dimensions, to the Orioles building a winning franchise. And the reason was that pitching friendly ballparks will allow you to keep your total innings pitch, total batters faced numbers down over the course of a season. And also allows your pitchers to not be, worried about throwing their hardest fastballs all the time. Palmer, for example, a pitcher who paced himself extraordinarily well throughout his career in terms of being able to still have something left he could reach back for late in a ball game. And that was a function of just not having to throw as many good fastballs in a game in that ballpark, which was a nice little feature of his career, and something that really helped the Orioles over the years.
And I'm surprised more teams currently don't view it the same way.
Yeah.
Because if there is one scarce resource in Major League Baseball, it's pitchers that can go deep into games, save your bullpen, get guys out a third time through the lineup, a fourth time through the lineup. And there was Comerica Park in Detroit. They built it to be huge, and now every year they bring it in a little bit. So they took the bullpen from the right hand foul ground. Thank you very much, and put it in left field, and then brought the fence in front of that, and then I believe Petco Field as well in San Diego. Just as they're just getting a competent team, they're just getting a contender for the first time since 1998, and they are sort of jeopardizing their pitching in hopes to, juice up hitting a little bit. Hitting's going to happen either way. Big ballpark, you're still going to get the gaps. You're still going to get the ball over the outfielder's head. But I mean, to do that to your pitchers on a daily basis, to make them, like you said, have to throw their hardest every time and eat up their innings, eat up their pitching, eat up their pitches for less effective outcomes. It makes no sense to me.
Yeah, I've never liked it. And Boston was able, with basically unlimited resources, to play in that strategy. But most of the successful franchises, Yankee Stadium, and particularly before the move, an enormous pitcher's park. If you look at the Dodgers, a big pitcher's park in L.A. So a lot of the teams, that have been successful for a long time have done it with good pitcher's parks. Certainly the Orioles fit in that group with their big run and having the best record in the 60s and two games behind the Reds in the 70s for the best record in the major leagues. So that was a great run. I did want to talk about the fact that baseball's been through actually many evolutions of the balance between hitting and pitching. And every time there's a general rule that pitching catches up to hitting over time. And so they let the game go crazy kind of offensively, a bunch of smaller ballparks brought in. Obviously the rest of the league adapted to the slugging nature. And in 1930, it kind of hit its zenith. When the National League as a whole hit 303,
oh, wow.
The Philadelphia Phillies hit 315 as a team, but they had a 671 team ERA and finished in last place.
There you go.
So that would do it. And all sorts of records were set in 1930, and they finally started to change the game, but still the lively ball era lasted until the end of the 40s. And then it was about a 25 or 28 year period of moving towards pitching dominance, culminating in the 1968 season, which is the all-time best for pitching. Bob Gibson had a 1.12 ERA and 13 mm-hmm. shutouts. And, what else do I know about that season that I can easily sum up? Yastrzemski led the American League in hitting with 301, and he had to rally to get to that point, or the American League might have not had a 300 hitter.
Tells you everything you need to know.
Yeah. And I think the A's led the league in hitting as a team at 240.
So the 2019 Orioles.
Yeah, they hadn't figured out the shift yet in that period either. Thank goodness for the hitters at that point. And we had the steroid era, and we had more juice ball suppositions. We had smaller ballparks, as you mentioned. So it grew to a bigger home run era, and now baseball's become this three outcome sport that is no fun to watch at all.
It's my biggest regret. I mean, again, baseball, I mentioned this in a previous episode, baseball is my favorite sport, and I just can't bring myself to watch non-Orioles professional baseball because of how it's played. It just makes no sense from a league perspective to continue to put this product out in this exact form and expect the national public to change their mind on what they're seeing. Right. We're going to all wake up one day and say, oh, you know what? I love to watch 12 walks and, 15 pitch at bats, that the game that takes 5 hours and the ball that's never hit onto the grass or onto the dirt. It's just mind numbing with what they've done. And what I think is one of the biggest crimes is that they just completely discounted the fact that defense can be exciting, right? So they're all in for homers are exciting. We're going to draw people in. It's going to be through homers. But baseball is a game of like small strategy. Each pitch, you're moving a little bit. You're picking a guy off, but you're not really picking him off. What you're doing is you're sending a signal to the catcher that you want a new, you want a new sign. And there's all these little matchup games that it's great to watch for baseball if they would just lean into that. And what they really need to lean into is the fact that if you put athletes on the field rather than just guys that like the Adam Dunns of the world, that all they can do is swing for the fences. If you put athletes on the field, Mike Trout, Cedric Mullins, and you just watch them fly around. I mean, even tonight, we're recording this on June.
By the way, don't tell me what happened in the Orioles games, because I don't know yet.
Okay, I won't tell you the ending, but in the very early innings, Hayes and Mullins both threw out runners trying to advance. And you don't get that with these lumbering sluggers that can't move around in the outfield and they don't have an arm because they have one of five tools. Look for these go back to looking for five tool players, put them on the field. You'll have a more exciting product and make the strike zone bigger. So they're actually taking the bat off their shoulder.
I actually like the idea of building teams to ballparks, and I, because there's only a limited number of five-tool athletes, it's not fair to ask everybody to look for them, in my opinion anyway. But what I'd like to do is each team to have competing philosophies about how to win at baseball. And like in the 1970s, we had the Kansas City Royals who were trying to win with speed and playing on turf. And even though I didn't like the Orioles going there because they weren't any good at it, it was something that I thought was good for baseball to have that as a competing philosophy. And if Baltimore says it's pitching defense and three run homers, well, we dare you to come in here with your bunch of 300 hitters and trying to win in Memorial Stadium.
Yeah,
because that's not the right strategy for that ballpark.
Not the right strategy for that ballpark or against that team. And I would say that's how I want to see every sport. Basketball, football, hockey. I want to see these competing philosophies. I want to see these teams made up of different, different stylistic game, the way that they play, also the type of players that they promote to the bigs. And the Orioles right now, they are hitting a ton of home runs. It's great to watch. But something else they're also doing that I'm loving is they're stress testing every defense by trying to stretch trying to get as many bases as they can every time the ball is put in play. You know, they're trying to go first to third. They're trying to go second home. Rutschman. Oh, and I won't spoil anything more than I already have, but, people are, you know, taking the extra base, and if they're out, they're out. We're not going to compete this year. That's fine. It's just a data point that you have in the future. Hey, if a guy has a average arm in right field, then this player can get to first to third on you know, in this situation, 93% of the time. You know, every time that they're doing that, every time that they're trying to do something a little bit different or a little bit against the grain of what the rest of the league is doing, it's promoting. Better product for the future when they're actually are competitive.
Yeah, I mean, I like that. In fact, I really like what Tampa Bay did to compete with the shifts and doing all the analytics they did to be a well-run franchise. I think that's good for the game. I don't think it was bad at all. A lot of people don't like the shift. For me, that's the hitter's problem. You got to figure that out. I mean, look, there's nine players. That umpire's card doesn't even have positions on it, other than the DH. Right. Because he's not responsible for keeping track of when your second baseman moves over to play right on the right field line if that's where you want him. It drives me crazy
when people say that they should outlaw the shift because, like you said, these are professional athletes. If there's nobody on the left side of the field, hit the ball to the left side of the field.
Yeah, there you go.
You'll bat 1,000. Exactly. Chris Davis, not to throw dirt on. I loved Chris Davis. I always appreciate what he did at his peak. But the thing that got me the madness wasn't that he, you know, his skills deteriorated. People's skills deteriorated. It's that he never tried to do something different, right? He always tried to hit the ball right into the ship. Chris, you were a good enough athlete to hit the ball the other way, to bunt, to get on, he could have batted right-handed. You know, I think he was talented enough to do that. But yeah, when people said that they should outlaw the shift, they'll go one step further and say that somebody, you know, they're going to draw like X's on the field, and the second baseman has to stand by this X, and the shortstop has to stand on this X. One of the best things I think that they've done recently is they started taking the shift a step further and having four outfielders and three infielders. Yes. And I love it. You know, one of the ESPN people was complaining about it. Oh, you know, Anthony Rizzo hit the ball. It should have been a double, but he hit it right at the outfielder. It's like, I Anthony Rizzo stand up double isn't exciting. The fact that they put in a strategy and the strategy worked, that's the only reason you and I are talking about this at bat. without this strategic advantage that was placed, that was implemented, that's just another stand-up double loss to the years, you know, loss to the wind. But because they're trying these new things and because they're doing innovative things, we're actually talking about it and we're getting excited about the different possibilities in baseball.
Yeah, I agree. And that's, it's something – there was a little bit of that played even when I was growing up in the 1970s. Jim Rice, one team used four outfielders against him. And I forget whether it worked or not, but it doesn't matter. They tried it,
right.
but it's actually coming into fairly unusual, but more frequent use this year. Adley Rutschman in his second game, they were playing four outfielders against him.
Oh, really?
You didn't catch that. Yeah. So that was actually pretty cool. Second game. Might have been his second series. I think it was his second game. I honestly think it was his second game. So anyway, some cool things certainly have happened over the years with regard to that. Let's talk about other sports for just a second here. Mm-hmm. The NBA, obviously, they've had two absolutely ginormous rule changes that I'm aware of over time. And you know, there have been other things about when foul shots are taken or not, or what's a bonus and this and that, and three to make two and that kind of stuff. I'm not really talking about that because those changes are a reflection in a way of free throw shooting percentage, but the 3-point shot, very fundamental change to the game in terms of how the game is played. You don't want to take a long two anymore. You take threes in college. Whoa, does a 3-point shot dominate, obviously. But the other one is a 24-second clock. And with it, the requirement to play man defenses instead of zone. So, you know, you have the opportunity for virtuoso offense defense matchups that you can isolate too. So that I think the NBA has tried to do some good things. The NBA is still popular. I don't personally like the NBA. It's my least favorite of the four major sports. But it's at least they've adapted in terms of rules.
Yeah, I would say hockey's probably the best at implementing new rules, even on the fly sometimes. I know that they one season it was like in the playoffs and they're like, all right, here's a new rule. So it's great to see when leagues are proactive about that. I would say the NBA is second. You know, they get new players in all the time, and the style of the game changes pretty much overnight. I mean, if you look at the game pre Steph Curry and post Steph Curry, it's a completely different looking game. So they're aware of it. They're putting in one of the things that they put in that I really do like is the offensive rebounds. It doesn't go back to 24 seconds on the shot clock. I believe it's 14 seconds. You can't, it's not resetting, and so you're still within the action of that missed shot. And it's, you know, it's more incumbent on you to try to score rather than put the ball out to the top of the key and reset. So that I really like, and I like that they're trying to do different things. I would like to see them maybe shrink the key again, because I think as we're going now, we're getting five smaller players. I think they call it small ball, right? So it's five shooters, five wings, and we're really losing that inside game, where I like the balance between the two. I like when you have a post player. I like when you have wings that cut. I like a one and a two guard that can both handle the ball and shoot it. So if they were to shrink the key, they could get some big men back to what they used to be.
Okay. I mean, honestly, when I hear you say that, kind of sounds like that's the way you grew up with basketball and you're comfortable with it being that way rather than having five shooting guards out there. But this is competing philosophies in play. If you can put five shooting guards on the field and on the court and make that work, fantastic. If you can win with big men, fantastic. If the smalls have too much of an advantage over the bigs because it's too easy to shoot from 3-point range, that's another matter. That's, you know, maybe then we need another 6 inches of 3-point range.
Like, yeah, I would say that, or put in a four-point shot. I think Trey Young and Luka could probably, and Dame Lillard could probably nail that on a, and Steph could hit that. My problem is not that, if it was half the league was small ball and then half the league was inside out, or even, you know, 20%, 20%, 20%. It seems like it's just all threes now. That was my thought process for shrinking the key. Like because you know, like you said, there's no point to take a long two unless you can dunk. There's no reason to go into the key. So it's either shoot a three or, you know, go back on defense.
To shrink the key, you're going to also shorten the foul line?
I wouldn't necessarily shorten the foul line, but just like it used to look, kind of
thinner key.
Yeah, thinner key. That's a better way to put it.
All right, I buy that. All right, that's an interesting idea. Let's get back to football here, because that's what people thought they were tuning into when they turned to our rule show.
But our bad.
Football has had a number of changes over the years for player safety. That I would put most of those in the minor category with regard to game outcome, not with regard to, you know, keeping your favorite players around. That's important, and I'm not don't want to discount that in any way. But in terms of game outcome, they've actually been pretty small. Other things in terms of game outcome also pretty small, but fans view them as important, like the effect of replay. Well, replay is a zero sum game. You know, there's one winner and one loser every game, and replay will change some of those from one column to the other, and sometimes it'll go the other way, and your net should be zero. And total games won is going to be the same in the end. But I think they've had a number of small changes. I'm trying to think of what was the last change since 78 when they made, you know, the enormous changes to the passing game that was really significant and game altering. From a fundamental standpoint.
Yeah. So you mentioned earlier about the Brady and Manning years, when it kind of, it was like greatest show on turf. Then it looked like we were going back to defensive dominance. And then it was when those two came in the league with, and then I would throw Rodgers and Brees in there, Roethlisberger, where offense has been ascendant, and I don't think there's been some outlier years like the 2017 Jags with a really great defense. But most of the years, most of the weeks, we're talking about great offense, high prolific passing attacks, and really defense is a secondary thought. Running is a secondary thought. So it's not only that it's skewed one way, it's skewed one way and then again towards just one aspect of offense.
One of the interesting things that's coming into the game analytically is looking at expected points and EPA, expected points added, for plays that are passing plays is much higher than for running plays. In fact, running plays are usually negative. Now, there are some across the league they'd be negative, but there are some reasons why that would be true. The first is that you run to close out a game when you're not really playing for points, you're playing for time. You're playing to reduce the clock. So you actually are perfectly happy to say, hey, I will give you expected points right. in exchange for taking time off the clock. Specifically, you make that trade. And just the same way, the trailing team is willing to give up turnovers in exchange for the opportunity to catch up. So they'll give up perhaps expected turnovers, whether it's expected points or not, pursuit of catching up. They ought to analyze that and try and take out run plays that were not done specifically to run out the clock, and then see how much difference there is. If that difference has gotten too great, and I can't define that for them. I would if they paid me to, but it's not my job. It's their job to really look at it and say, hey, do we have a game that favors passing over running too much? And it took one of the most extreme teams of all time to even convince the league that it could be done again with the 2019 Ravens in terms of having the greatest run team ever with one of the most dangerous players ever in terms of Lamar Jackson to be there to fuel it effectively. I don't really believe anybody's proved it's replicatable again. Maybe somebody like Malik Willis will, but it's not obvious to me that the running game isn't. I don't think it's likely coming back on its own. I think that it's the players that they bring into the league are not going to do it without some help from changes in the rules to make running easier.
Yeah. So I would 100% agree that it has skewed to the point where passing is just it's head and shoulders above what anybody mm-hmm. what anybody would ever consider. Like you said about the expected points per average. I didn't even know that stat, but I could have told you if you had asked sure. me, like, without knowing any stats, do you think that it's skewed too much passing? I would have said, of course it is, just by my own eyes. It is, as you and I have talked before, it's great to have different styles. It's great to zig when other people zag, and to be a Ravens fan during that 2019 time period, it was something else, because just when you got used to, okay, the only way that you can compete is to have one of these pocket quarterbacks, to have a average or above average to great wide receiver, and to have a line that can provide enough time to throw the ball downfield. And then here we come with this great 300 monster, this death by a thousand cuts. It's almost oxymoronic, but it was a high flying running attack. I've never seen anything like it. It was just 6 yards, 8 yards, 8 yards, 6 yards, 12 yards, 8 yards. Every time the defense looked clueless, we went 14-2. Only the 49ers, I think, made a game of it. Everybody else was just completely, outside of the two losses, completely floored right. by what we were doing.
Yeah, the way I would term that offense is they really inflicted progressive despair on opposing defenses with what they did. And, it was bad enough that in three downs of running the ball or one pass and two runs that they were getting a first down 80% of the time, they were doing it that way, whether they were running or passing on first down, which is very different. The rest of the league is way lower when running the ball on first down, which was telling you that you really ought to be passing more. But once they didn't do it in three downs, it's fourth and two. They're still out there.
They're
running another play. And you know, they might even run quarterback power on that play if you're Seattle and you remember that game. So first of all, I love to see the return of running the football, and I love the pass just as much as a lot of other people do. But I really love the way the Ravens took the league by storm and you know, had a revolution that year. It was a mighty fun thing to watch.
It sure was. And yeah, it's not if Lamar comes back this year and he's just throwing darts all over the field and we are the greatest show on turf part two, I'm not going to be mad at that. It was like you said, it was something we thought was gone forever. This dormant running power run game. And I don't mean power like running power plays. I mean, just like not a running attack, an unstoppable running attack that nobody really knows what the hell to do with. And just to be, you know, to have our team do that and to be able to watch that 16 weeks in a row. Well, I mean, it was just really an incredible ride. And you could kind of feel it in the city, as great teams as we've had. Like, I mean, it was a different kind of energy behind that 2019 team. It was just so cool. You know, this is a defensive city. We thought we were always going to have these, as much as I love Flacco, kind of these girl next door, you know, plain Jane quarterbacks, statues, you know, his outside of the Mile High Miracle, his sort of go-to play was a pass interference draw to Torrey Smith. You know, that was probably his his greatest sort of thing he had, trick he had in his bag. And then it's Lamar. He's like the greatest magician of all time. He's any trick that you could think of. And then that's not even counting, you know, how great Ingram was, or, you know, that was when Andrews started to really come into his own. I mean, it was really just the culmination of all of these, you know, or the combination of all of these things. It was like greater than the sum of its parts, and just really hard to put into words what it was.
It's the greater than the sum of its parts thing. I'll just add this to this. It's the fact that they can't determine what the value of the single most important part is why the sum of its parts are greater. And that's why PFF never really understood, never really got it right in terms of grading Lamar in terms of what his impact on the rest of the team was. But he loosened up defenses like nobody ever has. And that was a very, very special offense to work. They did it with one of the lowest, it might have been the lowest cap expenditures in that season on offense. And it's by far in the history of football, the best offense per relative dollar of cap. Has changed over time. Yeah.
Right.
So, you know, just absurd, absurdly efficient offense. So, I hope we can see something approaching that again, because the Ravens certainly are not built wide receiver, from the wide receiver position. They're built more to be a three tight end offense, and we'll see, you know, when they get 13 on the field, if that's going to be as special as it was in 2019.
Yeah, we can hope. To just sort of pivot away from the Ravens, we've been kind of dancing around this issue with the running game and it being, you know, sort of an afterthought. I hate to add fuel to the fire about the running backs don't matter debate, but it just really does seem that if you're not one of the offense or defensive players that affect the passing game in a major way, that you're replaceable, and almost that you, I mean, why even pay these guys a second contract?
Yeah, that's a great point. And we have a problem with our game. We have a problem with not having the proper set of competing philosophies. When analysts are on and are basically shaking their head at any pick that is not a pass rusher, quarterback, tackle, or wide receiver.
Right.
And they're saying, these guys just don't understand the draft. They keep taking people who don't affect the passing game. They keep shaking their head and, you know, doing this. And if you watch some shows that will remain nameless, they're out there. They're literally talking about that play after play after play. But that's a problem with the game. If run blocking and pass blocking, if the run game specifically and the passing game aren't on some sort of reasonably equivalent footing, then that's a reason why we probably shouldn't be happy. I don't know about you. I don't want the game dominated by pocket quarterbacks throwing to a select set of receivers. Like that's the largest possible imbalancing factor you can have in the NFL. We need competing philosophies, and we need running and passing to both be elements that can contribute to winning.
Yeah, no, that's my my competing philosophies. That's my philosophy for all sports. I want to see different things. I want to see the Reds bring a different philosophy to the game than the Blue Jays are going to bring. Right. I want to see and that's part of the reason, again, why we would be fans regardless if they were doing it differently. But the part of the reason that it was so great to see the Ravens do this is our team. And they're doing something that no other team is even attempting or would even consider attempting in this decade. And they're not only pulling it off, they're doing it with, you know, a flourish at the end and then, you know, a number one seed and all that. I think that the NFL, when we've talked and we've heaped praise on the NFL for the ways that they grow and the way that they manage their league. But this is one of the ways that I think that they could shoot themselves in the foot if they just become so one dimensional. And this is tanking for quarterbacks. You know, if you don't have a pocket passer and you don't have a number one receiver, you just can't compete in this league. There's really going to be five or six teams that can compete every year, and
it's horrible for the game.
So, I mean, whether it's a rule, a new set of rules that they put in, whether it's just incentivizing teams to think about this stuff differently, whether it's, I don't know, pay caps on quarterbacks and edge players and receivers so that they spread some of that money around. I was making a joke earlier about not giving these guys second contracts. That's a joke. I want these guys to get second contracts. You know, as much as somebody works to get to the league and then they give their body over and then they say, well, we can replace you with a undrafted free agent. So, hit the road here. I just don't think that it's good in any sense of the word, just in any sense for the league to have it all based on the passing game to this extent. You know, I'm fine to have a passing team or two, you know, like the Greatest Show on Turf, but everything else should be more balanced, or, you know,
or have some run teams. That's right. But one of the things that it encourages, if your running backs aren't going to get paid, your star athletes are going to gravitate to other positions. And Caleb Wharton was on the show talking about the wide receiver devaluation. One of his point was that, you know, guys get positional coaching younger and they have an opportunity to select their position earlier, demand it in college. You know, basically say, look, I'll come here and play wide receiver, but I'm not coming here to play running back kind of thing. Running backs, they move to corner, they move to wide receiver, but they move to positions that affect the passing game because that's the way the NFL is played. And if you're going to encourage that league, then it will have a self-fulfilling component to it when you basically pay only the athletes that are affecting the passing game. So the NFL probably will have to do something about it at some point. I also really dislike the way that the running game is ignored. The running game is much more complex, by the way, than the passing games in some respects. You know, it involves a lot of very specific blocking things where pass blocking is more general in nature. In terms of what your keys are, what you need to do on every play. Run blocking has more complexity to it in terms of what an offensive lineman, for example, has to do, but what all 11 need to do on the field in terms of their role. And I would like to see, broader, I guess, interest in that, I would say, but everybody wants to talk about wide receivers. Everybody wants to get the flashy players, and Twitter is a real problem with that. I would love the discussion to be different from we've got to do something, or you've got to get this ancient wide receiver fossil anytime he hits the market, because that's what I hear every time, and it's just I get depressed by it, frankly, when I consistently see it.
Yeah, it's the Ravens would have 10 Super Bowls if we just brought in Allen Robinson and AJ Green. It was all the quick fixes that we needed for our offense. Now I think we're in lockstep there as far as like, yeah, I want it to be more balanced and have, even some run heavy teams, but I don't know. This whole evolution, we've been giving suggestions about what they could do. I don't know how to do that.
How they get it? Yeah.
If you can get 8 yards on an out, and it's as low risk, it's probably lower risk than trying to get 8 yards on two consecutive run plays. You know, at this point, it's basically the quarterback handing the ball to the receiver, you know, six to eight mm-hmm. yards up the field. I just don't know how you incentivize teams to say, well, hey, like, have you thought of it? Maybe it's doing something against tanking so that teams that don't have a quarterback aren't tanking for a quarterback. And now, like, hey, well, we can't get a quarterback through the draft, so let's at least try to diversify
build our team another way. Yeah.
Try to build a run first team. And, you know, we can get a great running back in the second or third round. We don't even have to tank for it. You know, maybe that's a suggestion, but really I'm sort of tapped when it comes to that. As much as I'd like to see it, I don't know what they can do.
Yeah, I think it has to come from both directions. They have to make it easier to run somehow. And one rule they had that they I believe they've taken out now is consecutive linemen allowed to go high and low on an individual block. Defensive players hated it. It's actually very risky in terms of how the block is doing. It's a chop block if you go high and low otherwise, or on a pass play. But on a running play, consecutive linemen are allowed to go high and low to go high and low on the same defensive lineman. I don't want to bring that back, but I do want to make it somehow easier technically for the linemen to the offense to get an advantage on a run play out of the blocking scheme. And I don't know exactly what that is. I also kind of want to make it harder for the receivers maybe to get a clean release off the line of scrimmage, so the timing is messed up on plays and it makes it easier to shut down a passing attack. But then there needs to be something which basically makes it harder to complete a pass on third and four for a first down. Conversion rates are too high, and that needs to come down. And it's largely a function of just passing completion percentages have risen over time. We would normally expect that. It's been the history of the entire NFL that they've gone from, you know, under 50% to what are they are now, probably right around 65%. Mm-hmm. You would expect that problem to come up, and yet the NFL really has not answered it yet, except with making the passing game easier.
Yeah, and that's, I don't know if they are thumbing the scale to make it easier for the offense. That's what it seems to me. I know also know that with the 2010 concussion lawsuit coming out, they did things like you really crack down on head hunting, which is again good. Mm-hmm. I don't want anybody to, you know, you look back at some of the things that we celebrated in like the late 90s and early 2000s. You look at it now and it's like kind of makes you wince that, you know, now that you know what happens to these guys after their career. So I think it's good that they did that. But then, of course, anytime there's a vacuum, somebody's going to fill it. So, okay, well, if they're not going to really lay into me over the middle, now the middle passing game has really opened up and guys are less afraid to go over there. Even smaller guys can really make their living over the middle. So yeah. You know, if quarterbacks used to have just outside of the hashes to throw to, now they have the whole field to throw to with less risk to the receivers. And if even if they throw an incomplete and somebody touches them on the head or, you know, touches them on the ankle and they can get a 15-yard flag, and now they're, you know, there's just everything is geared towards the offense, benefiting the offense in some way, shape or form. Even I'm not saying it was intentional. I think a lot of this, especially like perfecting the quarterbacks, you know, they don't want guys blowing out their knees like Joe Burrow, and you lose mm-hmm. young stars. There's a lot of good that came with it, but just if they could dial some of that back, like we talked about replays on pass interference or quarterback hits, just so that they already have all these advantages that we talked about with it being skewed to the passing game. Let's not give them, you know, let's not let Aaron Rodgers flop his way to 15 yards and a new set of downs.
Right. I think there's ideas out there which can restrict the passing game in ways. You could allow certain types of contact in the defensive backfield under certain circumstances. Like if the ball's in the air for 2 seconds or something, I don't know what is the reasonable amount of time, but if the ball's in the air for a certain amount of time, then you're allowed to initiate some sort of contact as a defender. Again, would be one way if you wanted to restrict jump balls. If you want to make contested catches more difficult, you've got ways to that you could do that. Like you're allowed to arrive 1/10 of a second before the ball does. Mm-hmm. If you just said that and it was reviewable, even, I mean, that would be right. Fine too. Then that would be an interesting change that I think could do it. But it's all these things are difficult to put in the game. I think they're hesitant to make changes that would restrict passing, but at some point it's just going to become ridiculous in terms of the game being too centered around smaller players, around all the athletes being at the few positions that affect the passing game, and basically teams saying, okay, look, I've got to save money somewhere else. I'm never signing a second linebacker, never signing mm-hmm. a second running back. Tight end contracts for other than the pass catching ones are going to go to nothing. Offensive line is less valuable, frankly, because I can pass block easier than I can run block. There's probably other positions. Defensive line, the interior defensive line positions probably go down in value as well. So it's going to create a have and have nots. And if you're a inside linebacker, if you're a defensive lineman, if you're a running back right now in the National Football League, talk to your representation about changing the game in your favor a little bit, because it's getting out of hand, folks.
Yeah, it's your union too. Don't let the quarterbacks monopolize the conversation there.
All right. Well, great talking to you again about this, Colt. This has been a lot of fun. Is there anything else you want to say? I mean, just where do we go from here? Is there any other point? I mean, it seems like that's what we've been talking about the last 10 minutes, but.
Yeah. Where do we go from here? I mean, you and I both love football. Sounds like we both love every sport that they'll throw in front of us. I want leagues. I want teams to be open to experimenting. Right. I don't, mm-hmm. it's not that I want to see crazy new rules. I mean, some of the stuff with baseball, with like a runner on second base and the extra mm-hmm. innings, I'm not a fan. Like, don't do the gimmicky stuff. They had to do it for COVID, but whatever. Now that I think it's out in the next season. So thank goodness for that. But short of anything gimmicky, be willing to experiment. If you're not growing, you're dying. I mean, these, like we said, if you get so shoehorned, if you get so blinded into, okay, they love passing, they love home runs, they love three-pointers, that you can't see that 10, 15, 20 years down the line, it's going to be an unwatchable experience, kind of like baseball is with the three true outcomes. I mean, football might be approaching three true outcomes, incomplete catch or touchdowns.
Pass interference.
There you go. So, just because you got a good thing, don't think it's always going to be a good thing. Teams should be willing to experiment. Brandon Hyde, if you're listening, 5 infielders, 2 outfielders. I've always wanted to see it. One game when you're out of contention, just let me see it, and then I'll shut up about it forever.
Not the whole game though. You're just talking about specific situation, because you've seen that in your lifetime. They've certainly used 5 infielders in our lifetimes.
In Little League, I don't know if I've ever seen it.
Oh, no. They've done it in definitely the Gary Renicky batted in a 1979 or 80 game. I think it might have been 79 against the 5-man infield that the Twins used.
Okay.
Against the Orioles, and he flew out to left anyway. So it was flew out to the outfield.
Hey, the strategy works. There you go. Yeah. Anyway, yeah. So not to ramble, but yeah. These leagues are great as they are, but don't get stale. Don't get comfortable. Mm-hmm. Experiment. Try new things. Nothing outside, very few things are permanent, right? Try it. If it doesn't work, just roll it right back.
All right. Well, I'm all for that. And I definitely hope the NFL stays ahead of the game. They're brilliant in most of their decisions about marketing. And hopefully they will stay very good in terms of keeping the game balanced. And as they expand, boy, we talked about this on the other mm-hmm. shows, give people a chance to go back to them and listen to them. That expansion is going to force more variation in the play of the game. So I think that from that perspective, I think it will be a good thing.
100%.
Colt, been a tremendous amount of fun doing these four shows. If you haven't listened to all of them and you like this one, please go back and take a listen. We'd love for you to opine on these. If you jump in the comments section, that'd be great. We'll try and answer them there. Also, you can hit me up on Twitter if you want to talk there. Colt, tell folks where they can talk football with you.
Yeah, we've had this sort of running joke through these four episodes about how bad I am at social media, but I am on Twitter. It's Last Be More Colt, so hit me up. But what I'm really trying to promote, if you go to my Twitter in my profile, there's a link to my Substack. I'm trying to get my writing career off the ground here. So if you could give me a read and let me know what you think, I'd greatly appreciate it.
Okay, that sounds great. I see the Substack thing here, and I see you're up to three followers. That's great on Twitter. Yeah,
there we go.
So if this that doesn't at least double after hearing this episode, I'll be kind of upset because this has been, I think, a very good series. So other folks out there, if you'd like to be on a film study short, DM me. Always open on Twitter. I'll get back to you very quickly, I promise. Looking for narrow topics again, or a series of topics if you want to do that. But if you come up with a really broad topic, it's probably going to have to be chopped into multiple topics or made more narrow. So if you can start with that, that'd be fantastic. Colt, thanks again for joining us here.
And thanks for having me for this series. It's been so much fun. I can't thank you enough.
Can't say enough positive either, Colt. I'm looking forward to the next project. And we'll talk to you next time on Film Study.